If you're looking to save some money on your wireless plan, take a look at Visible Wireless. They're a transparent wireless carrier with nothing to hide. If you haven't heard of Visible, well, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Switch to Visible, where you can get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for just $25 a month, taxes and fees included. One line wireless, just $25 a month with taxes and fees included. That's unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Switch now at Visible.com. You shouldn't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. Like Visible, the wireless company making wireless visible.
Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Hey there, it's Rachel Ballinger, and I am thrilled to invite you to Rachel Uncensored, my podcast where I get real with my friends and celebrity guests, where we talk about all sorts of topics. From personal stories to hot button issues, we cover it all. New episodes drop every Wednesday, so make sure you tune in on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Trust me, you won't want to miss out on the fun and candid conversations we have here on Rachel Uncensored.
Hey, what's up, everybody? It's Ryan McCaffrey from IGN Xbox, host here of Podcast Unlocked. Welcome to the show. It is episode number 70. And it's September 7th, 2012. Joining me today is Empty Chair 1, Empty Chair 2, Empty Chair 3. Everybody's out and about or busy. Mitch Dyer is in Canada, getting rid of his car and vacationing, visiting his family. You heard about his epic road trip last week's show, where he was driving up to PAX and then driving to Canada and then flying back. And I can't wait to hear the stories of running into Neil Patrick Harris and craving White Castle hamburgers. We'll see what Mitch was up to next week. And then Destin Legarry is upstairs as we speak, and he is doing a live stream of Borderlands 2 with Randy Pitchford, the president and CEO of Gearbox Software, the developer, which is of course the company behind Borderlands and Aliens Colonial Marines and Brothers in Arms and Duke Nukem Forever and a whole bunch of other stuff. And Randy is one of the absolute delights to talk to in this industry. He's a very honest guy, but he's extremely passionate. I mean, you really get that from him when you sit down with him. And so I did sit down with him earlier today and recorded what turned into a 1 hour and 15 minute interview. So with everybody sort of out and about, and with an hour and 15 minute Randy Pitchford interview in the can, where we go over everything from what he was really thinking by picking up Duke Nukem Forever to what's going on with Brothers in Arms Furious 4 to, of course, Borderlands to what he thinks of the next generation Xbox. We get into all kinds of great stuff with Randy. And so we're doing sort of an Inside the Actors Studio version of the show this week. So I hope you enjoy it. We're just going to go me and Randy for the next hour 15. Buckle up, and we'll be back with the full crew next week. Lots to catch up on. Thank you very much, and I hope you enjoy the interview. We will see you next week. Yay! Joining us today in studio, very, very special guest, the one and only Randy Pitchford, all the way out from the Dallas area. Welcome, Randy.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
You're a tireless man. You were at PAX, and then you went home, and now you're right back out here just a few days later.
Oh, that's just a small part of the story.
You were in Australia seeing our Australian cohorts recently.
In between Sydney and PAX, actually, I was in San Antonio for the GameStop
convention. That's like a big deal now. Like, you guys have to all go kiss their asses because they're the buyer, they're the ones selling your games?
It's not. It felt actually a little more like the opposite, frankly. But I love it because, you know, the store managers at GameStop, they're on the front lines.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, as much as some of us might be cynical about the state of retail, almost all the people I've met from GameStop are gamers. And yeah, tastes vary, but these guys are gamers and they actually do what they do because they love games and they want to be a part of it. And I think I'd much rather have someone who's a gamer being in that seat than just a cynical, greedy kind of, you know.
But was it awkward at all? Because, you know, you on the developer side of the games industry, you and your colleagues all hate use game sales because it's an issue in the games world.
I actually don't hate use game sales. I actually love it. I just think that
you're not. You got developers should be cut in. Publishers should be cut in.
Yeah, I think there's a model that eventually we'll figure out where everyone gets a piece of it. But I think that as a customer, I think you know there's some neat convenience to that as an option. And I also think that there are some customers that we might be reaching through lower priced used sales that we wouldn't otherwise reach through full price, you know, customers that are on different budgets and I think it's up to us to prove the value of the retail game and to prove the value of owning it versus borrowing it or getting it secondhand. And, but I think there's still some value to secondhand stuff. I just think that there's a model there that can work. So I don't hate it. I just don't, there's this other weird part of it, which is, and I don't mean to interrupt you because I know there's probably a lot of things you guys want to talk about, but I've never really talked about this before. But there's this idea that if the value is the experience, right? The moment before I've had the experience, whatever that experience is, whether it's like burning through a quick campaign or it's a new hobby for me, whatever the experience is, if there's value to the experience before I've had the experience, the value, the potential value to me is at a premium as a customer. Mm-hmm. Like I want the experience, so I'm willing to pay a lot. Once I've had an experience and I've burned through it and I'm no longer interested in the experience, then the value of repeating that experience is very low. So there's this weird kind of gap that happens if the method to get the experience is to just have possession of this of a physical disc, for example, there's this moment before I've had the experience, I'm willing to pay a lot for it.
True.
And then after I've had the experience, it's almost worthless to me. So the idea of turning it over to someone for very little money is actually a decent value. And that's interesting because on the creator side of it, we don't really care about the physical media at all. We care about... We do it because we want to entertain, we want to create experiences, but we don't get to keep doing it unless we can afford to. So, you know, the we have to make more than we spend. And, you know, we're fortunately in a good seat. I feel pretty good about how we're doing. But, you know, there's been a lot of trouble that a lot of folks have run into, studios shutting down, layoffs all over the industry, and it's a difficult business for a lot of people. So I always feel for the cases where a talent that made good stuff that isn't here today, that was here yesterday, that might still be here if everyone who ever had the experience actually was able to get some of their payment towards that to the people that created it.
Get right up, get that mic right up next to you, Randy, because we don't want to miss a word.
I can do this if you want.
I mean, on that note, because we're just, you know, we're off script already, but I love it because this is a great topic.
We'll make our own script.
Yeah, no. So tell me from the developer side about retailer pre-order bonuses. Mm-hmm. Is that a big pain in the ass from the developer side where you have to cut all this extra content to make all of your retailers happy? Or is it one of those things where it's worth it to secure those pre-orders and know that you're going to have people coming into your product on day one?
Well,
because from a consumer side, it gets to be a huge pain in the ass.
It's very confusing and complicated when you have different pre-order incentives per retailer. I'm not going to say it's unfortunate, but there's this interesting component to the industry where it turns out that pre-orders are a really good indicator of how your game's going to sell. Mm-hmm. So on the business side, there's a lot of motivation from the machine of the industry to push for more pre-orders. The more pre-orders there are, if it's an indicator, then the more sales you would expect. So there's a lot of pressure to do that. Now, in the past, I remember for one of our games, I think it was Hell's Highway, we had different pre-order packages per retailer. In the case of Borderlands 2, we've done a single pre-order incentive that applies to everyone that can execute.
Yes.
So you don't, it's, so the thing that kills me as a customer is the mutually exclusive thing. If I get it, if I buy it from this guy, I get one thing. But if I buy it from this other guy, I don't get that, but I get this other thing. And it's like, I don't even know the value of those things. And so it's hard, it's almost impossible for me to make a decision. So we tried to eliminate that decision. We had a single pre-order option that anyone that can execute, like any of the retailers, and most of them can, most of the bigger ones can execute, will give you access, give you free access to what we call the Premier Club. And on Borderlands 2, the Premier Club is what unlocks all of the pre-order incentives. Now, there is one exception with GameStop in particular, because those guys, they really got behind Borderlands and Borderlands 2.
Yeah.
And they made a marketing investment, which allowed enough confidence to add a bit of a budget to create something. And so there's this thing called the Creature Slaughter Dome, which is exclusive to GameStop. There's no mutual exclusivity, so it's not like if I go with someone else or something else,
right,
I can
it's
get.
Just for,
yeah,
GameStop.
It's just GameStop. And that content actually would never have existed if it weren't for GameStop's investment. So normally I don't like pandering to a particular retail. I don't like playing favorites, but those guys made a bet there that allowed something to be created that otherwise would never have existed.
They scratched your back, you're scratching theirs.
I guess so. I mean, in a way, it really benefits them. I mean, they decided to really bet on it. They decided to count on Borderlands 2 and make it a big part of what is going to help GameStop succeed as a business.
And it seems to be a safe bet because the game is the hype is through the roof. I know your pre-orders are tracking. You know, speaking of you're saying that's a great indicator.
Yeah.
That you do have a ton of pre-orders. The game looks like it's going to be massive.
I can't believe it. Right now, like I was checking, like over the past 2 weeks, I've just been looking at the Amazon top. On Amazon.com top sellers list and the GameStop top sellers list and even on Steam or whatever, and it's Borderlands 2 is number one on all of those and what's weird is Amazon has this neat thing where you can see total sales for all of 2012.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see cumulative to date, because they do the hourly top list where it's updated hourly and it's like this rolling average over some period of time. Nobody knows exactly their algorithm, but they also have a cumulative for the whole year, and through some odd, I don't know what temporal vortex created this situation, but Borderlands 2 is actually higher on that list than Call of Duty. It's higher on that list than Halo 4. It's higher on that list than Assassin's Creed 3. Like, I feel like I've just walked into some alternate dimension where, because when we make a game like Borderlands, we know we're making a game for gamers. We're not prioritizing the middle of the road kind of dumbed down mass market gamer.
The people that buy two or three games a year.
Or one game a year.
Yeah.
Or sometimes no games a year. And, maybe they get one as a gift. We're prioritizing, real gamers and ourselves, basically. And to be in this world where that's what's being selected as the most interesting thing right now, I can't even fathom it. Borderlands 1 was such a sleeper that, it had such a long tail that I just can't even. I never imagined that this would be the seat we'd be in.
Well, it's interesting that we're talking about the projected success of Borderlands 2. I'm curious what you think. See, to me, it seemed the Borderlands 2 is the official and unofficial kickoff of the holiday season. It's the first of the real, real big blockbuster games hitting.
That's kind. I think technically the industry looks at Madden as the first indicator.
Well, that's a summer game, though. I mean, I don't think we can.
Okay.
And that's with no disrespect to Madden, but that's like clockwork.
Fair enough,
it's a summer game every year.
But they look at that as a. I know the industry looks at that as like the canary in the mine or the litmus
test. All
right.
So, well, Madden aside.
Incidentally, Madden's up this year.
They had
the biggest launch they've ever had.
We saw that, yeah.
And they had, I heard from some folks on the retail side from different retailers that it's as much as 20% over forecasts, which, I'm not a huge sports gamer. I do play the good every once in a while when a really good sports game comes out, but I'm really excited by that. That's a good indicator for our industry. But anyway, I didn't mean to interrupt.
So what I wanted to ask you about with Borderlands is... are you involved? I mean, because obviously at this point you've got to be thrilled. It's the way the marketplace landscape has shaped itself for the rest of the year. You've got a Halo in November. You've got a Call of Duty in November. You have a Resident Evil 6 in early October. You have an Assassin's Creed at the end of October. Your game is you're going to get those first dollars from people spending money over the next 3-4 months on games. Were you involved in that, or is that on the 2K side and you just kind of end up going, well, this is working out great?
Well, obviously we're involved in how we make our game and when we finish it. In terms of what the rest of the market does, no one has any control over any sure. other product. So, you know, the lineup is, that's fortunate. The cynical side of me kind of, you know, looks at it and goes like, yeah, you want to be all alone and you don't want competition. But, you know, the first game that Gearbox ever launched was Half-Life Opposing Force. Mm-hmm. And in that same month that we launched, Quake 3 Arena was launched, and so was Unreal Tournament. And so was the first Ghost Recon.
Yeah, but you had the Half-Life name with you. No, it doesn't.
Forget about the name. Four games all stacked on top of each other.
Right.
Like, everyone should have been dead. You know what? Each one of those games was great. And so each one of them actually exceeded their forecast.
That's true, but that was a pretty different era. I mean, things have changed a lot.
But it's true in this era, too. And to be objective, we can look at it from a different... we could look at a different industry. For example, I don't know if you go to the movies at all.
Sure.
I do. When there's a movie I want to see, I'm in that theater. And sometimes there's nothing I want to see. And sometimes things stack up. For example, a few years back, we'd have situations where, you know, the next Lord of the Rings movie was happening in the same week as the next Harry Potter movie.
Mm-hmm.
And guess what? We'd go and see both. But the prior 6 months, there wasn't anything that any of us really wanted to see on a massive scale. And so it was, we didn't even go into the theater. And that's the nature of the entertainment business. It sort of expands and contracts based on the kind of the quality of the promises that are being offered and how well those promises captivate the imaginations of an audience.
Well, to finish the point, though, you've got to be thrilled because Halo, the last couple Halos, Microsoft has taken this strategy of, we're going to go in September, or we want to get out there first.
Microsoft has always had either for this entire generation, there's
yes.
either been a Halo game or a Gears of War game
mm-hmm.
Starting after, like, every September. Every
yeah.
September there's been an Xbox 360. There's either been a Halo or a Gears of War.
And there's not
this
year.
And this is the first time that has happened.
So, as you guys are developing the game and you're projecting out and you're thinking, okay, we think we can have this out for the holidays 2012, you're probably thinking, well, there's probably going to be this Halo 4, there's going to be a Halo game in September. So then when there's not, and they decide to drop in November, and you're like, we got September to ourselves.
Yeah.
That's got to be a thrilling thing.
We talked about that possibility. Christoph and I talked about it. Christoph's the president of 2K Games, and our thoughts were, look, you know, if Halo does show up in September, that's what we expect. You know, that's the default expectation. We're confident in our game. We think we'll find an audience. We think the people that love Borderlands will be thrilled with what we've done because we've really blown it away. And we think that when a lot of new people show up, I think Halo will do great whenever it shows up. So we decided to just put our, like, that. That's when it was going to be. So that's when the game was going to be
yeah.
done and ready. So let's just put our claim in early. Let's not worry
sure.
about it. Let's not operate with fear. And we announced our date relatively early. We were one of the first ones of the holiday games to just
put your flag in the ground.
Here's where we're coming. And it turns out that, you know, Halo, I think that their date is not a function of timing strategy. I think it's more of a function of when they can.
Yeah, when they can get it done.
And honestly, as a fan of Halo and someone who's really looking forward to that game, I'm grateful for them to make a choice that prioritizes what the game, you know, what the game needs to be.
Always.
So if it means that, okay, so they break their September trend, that actually is really important to me as a gamer. I think both games would have been fine if both would have come in September. And I think Halo will do fine when it comes.
So I love talking to you because we've already had a great 16-minute conversation, and I'm now just now getting to the first question on my list. So
be careful. You'll get down three questions at this rate.
Well, we'll see how it goes. Fortunately, we literally have you all day. We have big plans for Randy.
Yes.
Randy's here. We're doing a lot of Borderlands 2 stuff with him. By the time this podcast airs, you'll have already hopefully seen our IGN Live, our live stream. We're going to be playing an hour or hour and a half or so of Borderlands 2 with Randy.
That's like a 40th of the game.
Yes, it's a big game. Randy's going to be on Up at Noon this week, so turn into our YouTube channel, on our Start channel on YouTube on Monday. for when that show goes live. And but now, for right now, you're all mine here on Podcast Unlocked, and I appreciate it.
I'm trapped. So,
I've been wanting to interview you for a while, and you know, you've just been busy. You said yourself before we went on the air that you're not even taking a vacation. You're busy. You got a million things going on, and
I love my job.
Yeah, I know you do, and that's why I love
to
you.
To me, what we do is vacation.
Well, like, and you have.
I'm happiest in the world when I'm part of creative processes and we're making awesome stuff happen.
And that's why, you know, without kissing your ass too much as you're sitting here, that's why I just legitimately respect you, because you have a big gamer score. You legitimately play games. You're not just a dude in a suit looking to profit off of the video game industry.
It is actually the greatest medium our planet, our species has ever devised. Like, it is not just entertainment that comes to us. We participate
absolutely
in the entertainment. There's no better entertainment medium
so
on the planet.
This is a perfect lead into my next question. You know, you're showing your passion, and I want to ask you, I kind of want to ask you seriously about Duke Nukem Forever for a minute.
Okay.
So the backstory for those that don't know is you were in on the very, very early days of development with that game, correct?
Barely.
But you got your start.
Technically, yes. I was at 3D Realms.
Yes.
I moved to Texas from California in '96, and joined the Duke Nukem 3D team, and I worked on Duke Nukem 3D stuff.
So you were a level designer,
yes,
right?
Yeah, and my content is in the Atomic Edition of Duke Nukem 3D, and I joined Alan Blum and those guys, Todd Replogle, and the other guys on the Duke Nukem team, and made some great friends and learned an incredible amount, and that was my first commercial product. Now, technically, Duke Nukem Forever did start when I was still there, but I left in 97, and I left it, you know, second half of 97, and my involvement in that was very minor. But while I was there, some of the original stakes were put in the ground, right? Like, he's going to go to Vegas, mm-hmm. and, you know, this is after the events of Duke 3D, and he's, like, famous and rich and all that, but the aliens come back, and just those tall beats were there. Right.
But the point is that you clearly, as you know, you are just making your passion for this industry clear. You know, you're a guy, that's where you got your start. So you have Duke and 3D Realms has a very special place in your heart,
In many respects, I owe my career to Duke Nukem.
And on that note, that's when Duke Nukem Forever, of course, became quite the project over the years. You know, it became infamous, not even famous. It became infamous. And at one point, it looked like it was finally over. The 3D Realms had shut down.
Yeah.
It looked
rough
like
day.
Yeah, it just
when we heard about that, that was tragic to us. I know a lot of people probably were on the sidelines laughing.
No. But nobody wants to see anybody lose their jobs.
To us, it was a tragic day.
Well, sure. It's never a good thing. And so it looked like that this 12-year, 11-year, whatever it was at the time,
that was
Odyssey.
2009. That would have been 12 years after it began.
It looked like this had finally come to an end. And then a little while later, it comes to light that you have stepped in and you have acquired all of Duke. You've acquired the whole thing, the game, the IP, everything. So what I just want to ask you sort of here is in a postmortem setting is, I mean, I played through the game because I was, you know, at the very least, good or bad, I was curious. I wanted to see
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
That curiosity.
I've never played a game for that reason.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I usually play a game because I'm very legitimately excited. Not that I wasn't excited to play Duke, but the overwhelming motivation for me to play through Duke Nukem Forever was sheer curiosity.
I've got to see what happens.
What the hell has what has this 14-year thing become? And so when you come in and you decide to pick it up, did you know in your you looked at it, did you know it wasn't that good?
I think it depends on perspective. You know, a lot of people put me on towing a line when I say this, but I actually like the game. I really do. There are, you know, if I parse it as a narrative, you know, FPS that is a linear progression, you know, and I've compared, I compare it to Duke 3D and other games like it or things like Half-Life. And when I say that, I'm not talking about whatever your particular perception of quality is.
Right.
But in terms of its design and pacing, it's that style of game. And the character and the situations are such where the things that I did when I played the content that they created and when I played through it, there were wild experiences that I've never had anywhere else and that I could never have anywhere else. I got shrunk down to this big, and I had to navigate through a burger joint, Duke Burger.
Yes.
You know, and I know I'm not objective because I have a certain affinity to Duke. So like, sure. when everything's going down and I ride the elevator up to his museum, and there's the Duke Nukem Museum, and he's like so famous in his world, and he's got his own casino, and his museum has all these relics on display of, you know, all the things that we remember from Duke 3D, but realized in true 3D in a current kind of engine. Like, it was just special to me. And the idea that he has a throne. Duke has a throne. And the throne isn't just, like, a place for him to sit. It's, like, how he accesses his Duke cave, which is, like, the back. It's, like, all of that stuff is just so awesomely insane that I really enjoyed it. I really thought it was special. And I had a good time with it. Now, you know, do I like every aspect of it? You know, I would have made a different game.
Yeah.
I would have made a different game. And I will. I didn't acquire the brand just so that could happen.
We'll get to that in a second.
But, you know, but I liked it. I had a lot of fun with it. So, and I'm happier living in a world where I got to play that content than being in the world where 3D Realms just shuts down, Duke dies, and we never hear from any of that again.
Right.
I'm much happier in the world.
And I agree with you. Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I am happy that I got to play the game, even though, I mean, I reviewed it at my last job at OXM, and I think I gave it a 5.5 or something. And, you know, it's...
That's borderline. Like, it's interesting, right? Like, and reviews are subjective.
Sure.
I think a fair score is between 6 and 8, depending on, you know, if you judge it on technical merits and all those other things. Subjectivity aside...
Sure.
You know, you can't quantify subjectivity.
I guess what I'm curious about after the fact here is, you know, I do as a lifelong video game player and someone who was around to play Duke Nukem 3D and follow the whole process of this, I do appreciate, despite the fact that I didn't care for the game as much as I'd hoped or wanted to.
Expectation gap is big.
Yeah, I mean, I do appreciate you
out of control.
For, well, sure.
It was a pretty awesome ride, I'll tell you.
But I do appreciate that you did come in and put it out. Now, and I think, you know, a lot of the hardcore shooter community does appreciate you for that. Did you expect the reaction it got? Did you expect people to generally, again, with all due respect, we to generally not really like the game.
Well, it's weird. Like, I mean, it sold well, and it's. I mean, we expected it to be polarizing.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, it's weird. I mean, I know your seat, and I know the perspective you have. You know, my seat looks a little different.
Totally.
We get a lot of fan mail. Every game we release, we get a lot of fan mail. I say fan mail. And there's two kinds of mail that we get generally. There's people that have some problem with something, whether it's a technical problem or a subjective problem, and they complain. And in general, someone that is unhappy with something tends to have a louder voice or be more likely to reach out than someone that's happy about it. But on average, with our games, we tend to see about 3 pieces of positive contact for every 1 piece of negative contact.
Yeah.
And Duke Nukem Forever was astonishing to us because the people that reached us, the ratio was actually 6-1 positive over negative. And that was weird, you know. And I'll tell you, like, I was just at the GameStop convention down there, and I didn't have a single person approach me, and maybe because it's me and it's uncomfortable, nobody approached me and said, man, that game sucked. But I had more than a dozen people, and these are managers at GameStop, approach me and say, you know what, thanks for doing that. I had a blast with it. I don't care what anybody else says. Thanks for making that happen. And that's why we fight. Well, why we fight. You know, so, if you don't like the game, don't get it. But like, if it doesn't appeal to you, but like, and I know that there was a lot of rubberneckers, you know?
Oh, sure.
And so it's hard. It's more like, if you're not buying the game because you genuinely like the promise, it's more likely that if you're a rubbernecker, you might see something that makes you uncomfortable, you know, than if you're buying something because you are attracted to what it's offering you.
Yeah.
If you buy something because you're attracted to what it's offering you, you're going to be you're going to be interested in that. So I think those are the people we tend to hear from. But I get that there's a lot of people that kind of are in this memory of this, you know, 15-year-long hype train, and during a large percentage of the, you know, part when it was at 3D Realms, the claim was, hey, we're taking forever because this is going to be the greatest game ever made, right? And that like, if that's out there, there's just nothing that could ever exist. Yeah. That can make that can live up to 15 years of expectation. It's just not conceivable.
When you go in and you look at it and you're like, okay, you know, I can save this. I'm in a unique position here, and you see that it's not going to be the usual very very high quality Gearbox game.
You got to be careful though, because you know, how are you defining quality? Because I think the issues people had are subjective.
Yes.
How do you measure subjective quality?
Somewhat. I mean, it's the game. The design of it is very clearly 90s game design. A lot of which, I suppose, you could say subjectively has not aged well.
I think it's a matter of taste. Like I there's a lot of games that are fundamentally along the lines of those design, yep, of that kind of design, where a character enters into a puzzle space, and he'll encounter a skill test or a cognitive test using that uses the interface to you know, make that test, and then through overcoming that test you move on. That's the game design.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and you know, maybe I see games differently, you know, as a game maker. Maybe I parse, but I think we can even have a truly fair discussion. I think that what matters is, like, to do it, you really need the game in front of you.
Yeah.
And you need to go, like, okay, where, like, when you say quality, what exactly are you talking about here?
Right.
Are you talking about because you don't think this joke is funny? Or are you talking about it because there's some subjective reaction? Because I can only come to the conclusion that people have quality concerns based on their subjective feelings about the design or the intent or the presentation of the game.
Yeah.
And so, I know that I am not objective about it because of my history with that particular franchise.
Well, nor should you be.
I'm like a chronic optimist. I wanted to believe, you know, and the game functioned great, and you know, it was fun to me. So.
And that gets right to my next question. Yeah. So when you come in, you're looking at it, was acquiring that game and finishing it, was it something you just felt like you had to do because no one else could?
Well, there's part of it. Like, I think that comes into it. I think there are two primary, you know, motivators from my point of view. One is, you know, I told this story once, you know, like, let's say you're in a car and there's a car in front of you, and it could even be like a fast, sexy car, you know, and suddenly the car loses control and crashes, and it's just a big explosion of fireballs and metal, and
yep,
people are bleeding. So already you've got a bad situation.
Yes.
Right. And you're following them. So what do? Do you keep driving, or do you stop and try to help? Okay. Now let's imagine that you're not in a car at all, but you're actually in an ambulance and you're a doctor. And let's say you're not on a busy highway. You're like out in the middle, yep, of the desert.
You're the
and
doctor.
There's no
in
one
this
else
scenario
around.
Yes.
And there's no one for hundreds of miles. Yep. It's like,
Do you let them die?
You're gonna, you know, I'm not. There's no scenario where I'm gonna let them die. I just, as a human, I can't do that. You know. So, and I don't want to live in a world where there's no Duke Nukem. I think he's an interesting character that has a lot of play in him. You know, and I think that there's a lot of fun that could be had there, and I think that you can do things with that property that can't be done with any other property.
So,
and I think he's huge. I think he's larger than I think he's larger than life, and both literally and figuratively. And I think there's a lot of potential there. So
because you went in and bought it, with your own money, because Gearbox owns it, not 2K. It's yours.
Yeah, yeah. That was the only way it was going to happen.
Yeah,
George would have burned. He did. He burned his own business to the ground before he'd let that fall into what he believed would be the wrong hands.
Right.
And to him, I think, especially at the time, the publisher was, any publisher was an evil, evil entity that was only going to scorch the earth and rape your brand. And I don't necessarily have those same views, but I understand where he was on that, and I think that it was only possible for him to trust a developer, and to trust a developer that has a particular history. I mean,
so
he was right to trust us, because yeah. It never would have, nothing ever would have happened, and it's only, and maybe the some of the decisions I make are irrational because of the personal affinity I have, but that's going to lead. I'll tell you, passion drives everything, and
it should.
And I love that game now exists and we get to play it. And I love even more that Gearbox can then now make its own Duke Nukem game.
Well, and that's exactly. So you've not been shy about in this interview or in the past about, you know, the fact that you do own it and you didn't buy it for nothing, and your desire to reboot the game. There's the rumor of a Duke Begins, like a literal little reboot. I mean, for you know, I'm not here to try and pry that out of you, because your PR guy in the corner will shoot me. But I do. I'm curious. Where do you think Duke needs to go gameplay wise in order to both be modern and entertaining, but still be Duke?
I think that the next Duke Nukem game needs to surprise and excite us on multiple fronts. I think it needs to surprise and excite us from a game design point of view. It should be inventive. Now, it shouldn't be so inventive that it's completely wild and unfamiliar, that we have no basis and foundation to parse it. But it should be wild and inventive enough so that there's a if you remember what Duke 3D did to gaming. The next
interactivity.
It's not just interactivity. Interactivity was a part of it, but it pushed, you know, it moved first-person shooters on a number of fronts.
Character.
In some ways, Duke 3D was actually the thing that needed to exist in order for Half-Life to be a natural evolution.
I agree.
And in fact, there's multiple people that were on the Duke 3D team that were part of the founding group of Valve that built that game, and I think that the next Duke Nukem game, from a game design point of view, needs to accomplish that same feat. It'll be in different ways, yeah. But it needs to bring something new to the table that's relevancy extends beyond just the mere entertainment experience that you get from consuming it. I think from a character point of view, I think that something very clever needs to be done there. We need Duke to simultaneously be able to use his character to push us into edges that we're not totally comfortable with, mm-hmm. but to do it in a way we can relate to.
Yeah.
And I think that might have been some of the subjective reactions that some people had to Duke Forever. The Duke in Duke Forever really committed to his 90s character.
That's true.
It really committed to his 90s character. And I did not, you know, there was some of that actually that made me uncomfortable, but I gave notes to the guys, you know, the guys that were driving it, but I didn't want to be a censor. And I didn't. I knew that I'll have my chance. I would have done it differently, but I did not. I liked it for what it was. I felt there was a certain charm to it, and there was a reflection of. I appreciate it, and this is going to sound odd. I appreciate it as art.
Take that, Roger Ebert.
Because I know who created it and what was driving them. But I think my treatment of that character, he won't forget his foundation, but he'll have to. He'll have to be cognizant of where we are as a species today and where society is today.
Right.
And he'll have to find that way to find what the new boundaries are that kind of dance around the uncomfortableness with those new boundaries, but do it in a way where we're endeared to him. The Duke in Forever, we are no longer endeared to. He's like a caricature. He's like Cartman.
Absolutely.
You know, he's like Cartman in South Park, where, yeah, he's kind of funny, but he's a dick and he's never a role model. The Duke in Duke 3D... back where we were back then, to some, he was actually a role model, you know, in some ways.
You know it, baby.
Yeah, it's like they're almost celebrating that machoism. But we've evolved as a species and as a culture since then, and the character embraced where he was and just had fun with that premise.
Is it the same way that, you know, Adam West Batman was appropriate for 1960
Absolutely.
Television and the way Nolan Batman is appropriate,
you know,
now?
You think about Batman. Think about Batman. Did you see Batman and Robin with Mr. Freeze?
In the theater, and I nearly walked out.
Okay, so imagine if whoever was responsible for Batman, whoever was shepherding that.
Joel Schumacher, the director.
No, right? I'm talking about the brand.
Oh, okay.
Use that experience as an indicator of all things possible and gave up there. Imagine that. We would never have what Christopher Nolan did.
Right.
And the character itself has a lot of potential.
Yes.
And so I viewed Duke Nukem very similarly. And maybe to some, you know, maybe to some people, forever is Batman and Robin. But does that mean that's the end of it? It's like, no. To me, the worthy challenge then is, okay, what's the Christopher Nolan quality resurgence that has to happen? And when, you know, what is that? And that to me is a really interesting question, a really interesting challenge, and a worthy challenge. And those that do that and offer that and deliver that, they're creating.
You're a hero then if you do that.
It's great, right?
And then and maybe there'll be some new console technology coming down the pipeline that can help you put that vision into reality.
You know, more power is always nice, but I think that the issues there are not
they're design.
They're not going to be solved by. I think the solution to that is not limited by technology. Yeah. I think the solution to that is a creative thing.
So. We're here to talk about Borderlands 2, of course. But real quick, I got to ask you, because this just came up at PAX. Furious 4.
Yeah.
What is going on with it? It's dropped the Brothers in Arms name.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, the big question for you that hasn't been answered yet, does that mean, so Ubisoft owns Brothers in Arms?
No. Gearbox owns Brothers
in Arms. Okay, Gearbox owned it.
Yep.
Is Ubisoft still publishing the game?
Haven't talked about publishing yet. I did say that when it appears again, it will be a new IP.
Okay.
We'll be. In fact, I do have some. I did say that we're going to have some things to talk about that at our community day, which is on the 15th.
Coming up.
So September 15th, and that's in Dallas. And you're actually welcome to come to community day if you want. We'll have some more announcements along those lines. As far as publishing goes, when we reannounce the game, that's when we'll come with all of that information.
Fair enough.
So I made it clear at PAX that what I was offering at that point was I wanted to make it really clear that the game, like I think I talked before at some point how the game's evolved, because somebody asked me like, hey, I won't even see him for all. It's like, you know, when we started that project, we really committed to the design loop, and we wanted to kind of push some things. We wanted to, we unhinged the constraints enough in the kind of iterative pre-production process to allow design to evolve. And when Furious 4 was announced, you could already see that the gameplay and the as a consequence, some of the style and feel had evolved beyond what we would normally expect from a Brothers in Arms game.
Absolutely.
And since that moment, it was continuing to evolve, and it's actually gotten a lot farther. And we realized that if we separate the brand expectation that Brothers in Arms brings from it, because the gameplay evolution that we're going through is extremely exciting, like really awesome. Like, you know, if you think that it was cool how Gearbox figured out, how we figured out as a team how to bring in RPG elements to the shooter for Borderlands, what we're doing, where that's evolving is crazy awesome. And so there will be a time when, you know, I know right now, because I'm kind of indicating, hey, a shift has happened. There's like, well, what caused the shift, and what does the shift mean? And I get that. Let's get all those questions out of the way, because what'll happen later is when we announce it, there'll be this whole new thing to parse.
Sure.
And that'll be the discussion then. It's like, what is it? So I get that there's that transition. Now we're not quite ready to announce it yet. And the biggest reason is because it is still evolving, and if I re-announce it again while it's still evolving, there's a chance
you go into Blizzard mode.
There's a strong probability that it continues to evolve again, and then I have to do it again.
Yeah.
And so let's get sufficiently far enough where when we make the promise, we are committed to that promise.
Right.
I don't want to make a promise I'm not committed to. And I know it's cool, we won't take it as a promise, just tell us what you're thinking. But it doesn't work that way.
No, it doesn't.
I say anything, and then anyone who covers it will just take the little bits out, and that becomes a new promise.
That's right. There are headline writers downstairs right now just waiting waiting to type out what you say.
So I'm going to be very careful about that. Now,
fair enough.
On the you know, just to clear up the brand situation, so Brothers in Arms is a gearbox brand, and we love what we've created there, and we have internally committed ourselves to continuing that as well. And I've also said, look, there will be more Matt Baker, and there will be more of the Authentic Brothers in Arms.
Great.
And it actually is, and I'll actually talk more about that at Community Day as well. But it became very clear to us that we need that, you know, we might have been, because we were, you know, kind of exploring something with Ubisoft, you know, we kind of felt kind of attached to the Brothers in Arms thing, even though we were exploring gameplay in a different direction.
Yeah.
So by detaching that entirely, we are free to let that game become what it is supposed to be and meant to be and what it deserves to be on its own merits without even affecting at all what Brothers in Arms is supposed to be.
Wow.
And it actually is the best of all worlds. So I'm really excited about that. And that's one of the reasons why I want to talk about it. I think if you are a Brothers in Arms fan, you're really excited by two pieces of information. One, this Furious 4 thing is not corrupting Brothers in Arms. In fact, that's going to go on its own thread. And two, we love Brothers in Arms and have something going on there, and we'll be talking about that down the line.
Well, I'm with you, because when I saw it last E3, you know, a year ago, I thought, that's a neat game, but I wish it weren't called Brothers in Arms.
Isn't that interesting?
Because your Brothers in Arms games are, they're, for all the other World War II games out there, Brothers in Arms is a very hardcore, realistic tactical game.
Yes.
It was a niche that nobody else was doing.
Yeah.
And for Furious 4, it's like, well, this game's kind of neat, but it should maybe be called Inglorious Bastards the game instead of Brothers in Arms. So I have liked this news.
So that's the other part of it, right? So if you're a Gearbox fan, the idea that we are unhinging any constraints and exploring game design more freely, in letting that evolve and iterate, that creates obviously lots of questions. What is it? But the possibilities are exciting. So that's neat to me too. And I'll let you in on a secret.
Please do.
When that announcement for Furious 4, you know, a couple E3s ago happened, to me it was also a litmus test. At that moment in time, I was already thinking this should not be a Brothers in Arms game, but you know, our publishing partners were convinced, and there's other people that were convinced. And so I'm like, well, there's only one way to truly find out. So let's just tell people what we're doing, and we'll let them tell us. I was really gratified by the response, because it told me I knew exactly what was going on. Like it's hard to be objective when you're in it, but it turned out that I objectively understood exactly where we were and what that meant, and what that led to was us, you know, being able to do what we needed to do.
Well, that's a testament to you and the strength of the position that you've carved out for Gearbox, because if you were a wholly owned subsidiary of a publisher, you probably would not have been in a position to do that.
Yeah.
So
that's true. But, you know, I think that one of the reasons why it works for us, what we do, is because what we do is driven by our passion as gamers and game makers. And we've made sure to not get ourselves into situations that compromise that strength to be in play, and our best partners get that about us.
Yeah.
You've worked with the
same partners. Ubisoft and 2K have been frequent partners over the years. We also work with Sega.
Sure.
And
you know, on the Aliens game, where, you know, 20th Century Fox owns Aliens, and you know, and we've worked with Microsoft, and we worked with Activision, and we've worked with EA, and we've worked with all the guys. And whenever we've worked with these guys, the best results have always come from those that get us and you know, let us do our thing and ask the important questions, of course, and inform us of their constraints so that we can work, you know, because we want success for all of our partners.
Right.
It's been really neat, you know.
So,
and I think it's really just about being honest and communicative, and being transparent with your partner. And I think that's really the secret to our success.
It sounds so simple, yet it seems so rare.
Yeah.
And for listeners who may not be aware, a little extra Xbox cred for one, Mr. Randy Pitchford, he and his team did the PC version of Halo 1.
That's so, right. Yeah.
And with some kick-ass maps, by the way.
Yeah, yeah.
The maps you guys did, Infinity was was amazing.
That, you know, Matt Armstrong designed that, and he was actually the director of Borderlands 1. Like,
There you go.
If you can think of, if you can name one guy that is most responsible for the game design bet that we made from an execution point of view, Matt Armstrong is that guy, and he built that map, Infinity. Yeah.
And in fact, one of those maps were so good that one of them, Microsoft even borrowed for Halo Anniversary last year.
Hey, it's all their stuff, and I was so thrilled that they trusted us and invited us to be a part of that. You know, and to me, it was really great to play Halo on a mouse and keyboard, and to play it on my PC, and to be able to play on the internet for the first time.
Yes,
because Halo was not an online game at all.
Oh no,
there was no online.
Nope.
You could play it on a LAN, or you could play it local split screen, but there was no online multiplayer. And you know, we're in a world where we're going nuts with Counter-Strike and stuff like that on the PC. So to be able to, I'll tell you, that was a difficult and very stimulating challenge. The guys like Sean Reardon and Steve Jones and Jimmy Sieben, who and Scott Velasquez had a lot to do with that too, who really dove in there and re-architected not just the networking, but the engine and the game. Because Halo, when we got it, was designed as a synchronous deterministic simulation, which is the worst possible scenario if you're on the internet, where you have things like latency and packet loss and you're getting packets out of order and all kinds of odd things happen. People's connections drop or are inconsistent. So we had to transform that entire architecture into something that is non-deterministic and asynchronous. And this is the catch. We had to do it in a way where from a customer point of view, the original simulation still feels intact.
I guess they should have called you guys to put online multiplayer into Halo Anniversary then.
Maybe I actually didn't try the online. I respected that. I didn't try the what did they have
well,
online?
Well, they just did a map pack for Reach.
Oh,
they
see.
Did not. You
I
know
see.
That was a big beef of mine as a Halo 1 old school fan was I wanted to play Halo 1 online, and they for technical and no doubt budget and time reasons they instead opted to.
It is a hard problem.
Oh,
I think most teams would have been nervous about doing that work. It's very technical, very challenging work, and it takes some serious chops and experience. To the credit of the gentleman I mentioned, Gearbox was able to do that work for I think under $1 million and in less than a year. Which is like
that's impressive,
and that component of the work would have been nearly identical. The consoles have some different TRC kind of situations and some other kind of constraints, but the from a functional point of view, that work would have been nearly identical in this reimagining they did as it was back then. Because that part has nothing to do with fidelity.
Mm-hmm.
It has nothing to do with. It's all to do with the simulation and how information is simulated across multiple machines that are connected together in some way.
So Borderlands 2, you're shipping that game in just a couple weeks' time. The story goes that the art team snuck off during Borderlands 1 and, without telling you, completely redid the art style from a more... I mean this in a not mean way, generic Unreal Engine 3 look to the very distinctive comic book style that we see now. And then they just showed it to you. And
Kind of. What happened was it wasn't the whole art team. It was actually one of my partners, one of the owners of Gearbox, Brian Martell, who, there was a moment when he was struggling with, and all of us were struggling with this idea that I'm about to say, which is that there was sort of a mismatch between the style that the game was actually being built in and the style that the game was kind of supposed to be. We didn't know what that style looked like, but the design of the game and the universe begged for a certain flavor that we just hadn't discovered yet. And invention's one of those weird things where you can't really predict it, and you can kind of know you need to do something, but until you actually invent it, you don't know what it is, but you know that something needs to exist there. So
chicken
so
and the egg.
It's a really odd situation. So Brian took personal responsibility for that dissonance that permeated, I think, the entire studio. And you know what's neat about a game is it's complex enough where even if like there's this dissonance between the visual style and the game design and the story and all that. There's this dissonance there, but because I'm my responsibility is this, I can focus on this or that. I can focus on that. Well, Brian, you know, in his seat as you know, he's basically the creative head of our studio, and he's one of my partners, one of the owners of the studio. He is an artist, and he took personal responsibility for that particular dissonance and the discomfort that it caused, and set himself out to solve it.
So he
gathered together a couple of guys, and they started exploring possibilities. And it was when they, you know, probably a couple of days into them tinkering that someone else came to me and said, "Hey, Randy, have you seen what Carl's doing?" You know, Carl was one of the guys that Brian was exploring this with. So I'm like, "What do you mean? Isn't Carl doing what everyone expects him to be doing?" And they're like, maybe you should talk to Brian. And so I went to Brian and I asked him, like, "What's going on, dude?" And he's like, "Listen, I reminded me of the dissonance. Yes, I agree." He's like, "I think I can solve it. I need to dig in and try. There's no way that we could use the English language isn't sufficient for us to describe what I see. Mm-hmm. So I have to actually build something to show what I see, and I need some other people to help me do that." And so we agreed that he would spend a few weeks, like 3 weeks, and that he'd have like five guys,
yep,
and that they would basically make a prototype.
So do you think that the game would have been as successful if it had retained its original look?
Man, I don't know.
I know, an impossible question, but
I'll tell you, the game design is really strong. I think that the look makes it very distinctive, which creates advantages. It helps people recognize when you see a screenshot or an image of Borderlands, you know it's Borderlands.
Yes.
And you know it's nothing else. So I think that there's some advantages there. I also think that by making that change, it then amplified some of the other things in the design and in the way that the story we're telling to let the character that it wanted to be come through in a much higher volume. And you could even see that momentum carrying it even further as you play the DLC, for example. The game design's very strong, you know. And I also know that as a counterpoint, there's still some people out there that like they'll go to a store and the guy like, "Oh, dude, you like shooters and you like role playing games. You should look at this." And the customer who's more muggle like, "Yeah, but it looks kind of like a cartoon." And the guy's like, "Just forget about that. Just try it. And trust me, you'll like it." You know, so there is some other part where, you know, there's almost a ceiling caused by that. So it's almost impossible for me to know where that, you know, if that's a coin flip, where that would come up heads or tails on that particular question. But my gut says it helped a lot with it. But I can make reasonable and strong arguments that a realism version could have also been very successful.
Now, Borderlands definitely, the game touched a nerve when it came out in a good way. You know, it managed to just grab onto people and not let go. So what I'm curious of is at what point during the development did you guys realize that you had something, that's what the effect on people was going to be?
Pretty early, actually. when we first got some of the procedural weapon generation system stuff hooked up and we're proving it, you know, testing, playing with it. It's just, I think we still even have it in Borderlands 2, the P key. You press on in our developer build, developing on our, you know, workstations, mm-hmm. you press the P button on the keyboard and it'll just spit out a procedurally generated weapon using the procedurally generated software. This is just like a shortcut that I think Jimmy just coded up one day. I've got all the pieces now. I need to create a result and manifest it into the world. I'll just associate that with the P key and, you know, for pistol, I think is why it was P.
Yeah, yeah.
Make pistol, you know, and like like, you know, you first get in there and you press it and you see it's like, oh, cool, all the pieces work and, you know, their stats, cool. And then you press it again and you start spamming weapons all over the world and you're like, and you're just, you know, we're spending, you know, 2 hours went by and all we did was just look at stats and gear that we just spawned ourselves on the floor and we realized, oh, shit, we're onto something, you know, so very, very early. That was pretty clear.
So I've just got a couple more questions for you. Do you guys ever worry that at Gearbox that you have too many projects going on at once? And what I mean by that is you guys, in a bid to get it right, which you almost always do, you guys delay a lot and your dev cycles are pretty long. Do you ever think, did you ever consider scaling it back and maybe just focusing more on one or two things at a time? You guys always seem to have three or four or more things cooking at any given time.
Okay, so I'll comment on the multiple project thing, and I also want to comment on the timing. You know, one of the weird kind of side effects of this industry is sometimes something motivates communicating about a game earlier in its life cycle, and like announcing it or whatever.
Yeah.
And something motivates that. And once that happens, then the natural next question is, when does it come? And you know, we want to be developers. We don't want to be publishers, and the publishers are amazing. They care so much about what they do. So they're in the best seats for that. But because they all tend to be publicly traded and they all have,
shareholder expectations.
There's that. And then there's just the way the market works. They always need to put in either a year or a quarter or a date,
yep.
You know? And so, you know, what happens is when you start a project, you actually kind of go into it with this kind of understanding of where you're going to be flexible and where you're going to be inflexible. And it's usually along the vectors of how much money can I spend? How much time am I going to spend? And what is the goal from a vision or a scope or quality point of view? Like, what is it I'm trying to build? So what am I trying to build? How much am I going to spend on to build it? And how long am I going to take? And on one of these points, you tend to choose that you have to be inflexible. So some projects, date is inflexible. Like if you're going to make a game based on a movie that's going to come out day and date with the movie, the date is inflexible. And if your date is inflexible, then what you do is you adjust the scope, the quality, the design, the nature of the game, or you adjust its budget. Usually both. Mm-hmm. You adjust both in order to make sure you make that date. If you're going to be inflexible on budget, you need to be willing to adapt your scope, your quality, or your schedule. If you're going to be inflexible on your vision, then you have to be willing to adapt both your budget and your schedule.
Makes sense.
So for some of the games, I think our biggest and best games, we've bet on a goal and we've chosen to be inflexible on the vision, which means that schedule and budget are going to be flexible. Which means that if you've talked about the game and the powers that exist, the nature of the machine inserts dates into the equation, then that an expectation is set. So, but if you were actually going to be flexible on that because you're committing to your vision, the schedule might change, right? So, you know, so like if you look at like Borderlands 2, for example, we didn't announce a date at all until we had it.
Yep.
And we nailed it and it's coming. Aliens, that game was announced
a long time ago.
The press release that announced that game would exist was put out to the world before we had written the first line of code. Which is, you know, when it ships, the actual length of development is about the same as every original game we built. It's just that it takes time to bake and to figure things out. And so it's actually no different in terms of its development cycle, but it appears to be really long because of the press release that happened way early, and all along the way, you know, there's like, oh, they're going to put a date, and there's actually never been a date until we recently announced a date. There's been years or guide. There's been guidance basically, when we hear guidance, though, we don't hear the word guidance and we don't parse the word guidance. What we hear instead is that's the date.
Yep, put it on a calendar.
Yeah, and there's never actually been a day date. There's been like a year or a season that's been offered as guidance. So maybe our industry needs to mature so that there's a language, both that we can communicate to guys like you mm-hmm. and that guys like you can communicate to the world, which says, okay, this project is going to be inflexible on date, so you can count on this.
Yes.
Or this project is going for a vision. Here's the guidance they've given us for date, but because it's going on vision, we'll see what happens. You know, and I don't know how to what shorthand can be created to help communicate that, but that does create some distance. So that's a comment on the timing issue. In different projects, if you look through our entire history, you can see examples where we've appeared to move our dates, and you could see other examples where we've been like you could set your clock to what we're doing.
Yeah.
And it depends on what the commitment of that game is. Now on the other point, which is multiple projects, we've done both at our current scale, and our ambition. There's this weird kind of thing. On one hand, we feel quality at our studio at these moments in a project when we can rally a mass of people around something. So there's a lot of focus and quality and performance advantages that happen when we kind of focus. On the other hand, there's a different kind of both creative and technical efficiency that comes when we have multiple things going on. There are lots of aspects of development that use the same pieces of stuff, whether right. it's technology or tools or whatever, no matter what game you're making. If we can amortize that across multiple projects, we can actually be more efficient and we can make better games with the same amount of money or even less money. And that's our real goal, is the same amount of games. Creatively, if you work on the same thing for a long period of time, you could start to get stale and
very true.
And burned out. So we get creative and emotional advantages from having lots of things going on. Also, logistically, the phases of development are such where at different phases of development, there's a different kind of efficiency and quality that comes from a different number of people. So in pre-production, or actually in idea phase, you want like just a handful of guys, two, three, like when you're building your concept, just two, three guys are good enough to develop a concept. Then when you're in pre-production and you're exploring the concept, you know, your team grows to a dozen to 25 people.
Mm-hmm.
When you build prototypes, depending on the complexity of a prototype, you can get a little larger than that. When you're in full production, you know, you can, like, I think at its peak between the internal staff on Borderlands 2 and external people, there's probably a moment when there were over 300 people
wow.
working on Borderlands 2. Now imagine if we had one project in development. And the optimal thing at the very beginning was to have five people. Mm. And the optimal thing at peak production is to have 300 people. And then in post-production, again, you want to get down to like your 30-man launch team. And then that actually shrinks to like a 16-man, you know, 15, 16-man kind of live team. Imagine if you had one project. What do you do? You're going to do one of two things. You're either going to be hiring a lot of people, which at that point are, you know, you're going to start small and you're going to be hiring a lot of people, and the people you're hiring, they've never worked with each other. There's no cohesiveness. There's no, you know, we get tremendous advantages because we don't have really any turnover. So everybody at Gearbox knows each other's strengths and weaknesses. We leverage each other's strengths. We anticipate and mitigate each other's weaknesses, and it's just sort of automatic. And I could say, I don't even have to say, I can look at Brian and give him a look, and he can get what would have to be paragraphs, pages, volumes of information for someone that I've never met before that I'm trying to communicate with. Just a single look carries all that information. And this is true all over their studio. So I don't like the idea of like hiring and firing.
Yeah, inefficient churn.
That's what you're talking about. It's just the worst possible way to make quality games or make quality makes anything, sense. In my opinion. But the other side sucks too, where like, okay, so let's say I'm not going to hire or fire. So where's the line? How many people do I have? Do I have the maximum at peak, which means that for these huge parts of development, I have these gaps where there's a whole lot of people that we're spending money on that are not creating anything of value and that really just have to sit around and twiddle their thumbs? Or do we put the line below peak so that we may be a little heavy when we're in pre-production, but we're light when we need to be stronger, you know, and then
yeah.
the games aren't as good. So having multiple projects allows us to kind of do this kind of thing where one project's at peak while another project's in pre-production and do this dance back and forth. And that's really awesome. It also allows us, and I think this is really neat too, to amortize these kind of common things. And an analogy which kind of helps this be really simple to understand is imagine you're building a building, like a physical structure.
Okay.
Now, everything that's going to be part of that building, the mortar, the metal, all that stuff, that's all going to stay with the building, and all, whatever that costs, that goes into the building. But there's a whole lot of other stuff you need. You need the trucks that you got to put all that stuff in to drive it there. You need hard hats for all the workers. You need scaffolding to erect around it. You need drills and cranes and hammers and screwdrivers and all this stuff. Imagine if you had to rationalize the cost of all of that stuff just within the building. It's going to cost, you know, let's say X. Now, if you can make three buildings that all use the same stuff, the value of that stuff then is spent once. Or you could even buy more. Let's say let's say you had this, if you had the same budget, you can get three times better stuff or three times more stuff. Or you could just do it once and you're being more efficient, so that each game could have more of the budget of each building. For example, could have the things that are exclusively for that building. So maybe the walls could have been better, and the floors could be better, and the glass could be better, and the stuff on the outside of the building and inside of the building could be better, because we're spending less of that particular building's budget on all the tools and all the scaffolding and all the infrastructure. And I can't underestimate the value of that. And there's so many, and it's not just physical stuff when you're making software. It's institutional knowledge as well. And that's very, very valuable.
So, all right, a couple quick rapid fire ones to finish up. Do you ever think about Prax War, the very first game from when you first left Gearbox? You started a development studio called Rebel Boat Rocker, and that game ended up never coming out. Do you ever think about that game?
Yeah, every once in a while. We've got a poster for it that hangs up in our office. Every one of the owners of Gearbox worked on that game, Brian Martell and Stephen Ball, and a lot of other people were at Rebel Boat Rocker. You know, I don't think that exploring that again is going to matter, because what we were doing there, what we wanted to do there, what our ambition was from a design point of view, Bungie did it with Halo. They did it, and that game exists, and now we get to have it. And so I don't feel like all the things we wanted to do there are no longer uncharted territory.
Right.
When we dreamed it up and were ambitious about it, there was no Halo in the world, and there was no game that kind of blended put the pieces together the way Halo ended up doing. And that's what Prax War wanted to be. And as Halo existed, it no longer became useful or relevant to do that. There's some of the story things that I kind of liked that have, you know, some of them have actually appeared in other games that we've made. And there's other ideas that have kind of, you know, appeared. But the core, you know, from a top line kind of nexus of story, style, and design, Halo did it, so we don't need to.
And what game are you most excited for this holiday?
Well, I'm going to expose my gamer nerdiness. I'd have to double check the launch date, because I was a little fuzzy on it. I think it's coming in December, but it might be coming in January. It's Ni No Kuni, which is the Studio Ghibli-inspired level 5 game. Man, there's something about that that just is really attractive to me. And so, yeah, I know that's not at all mainstream. But I can't wait for that game. Obviously, you know, we got Borderlands 2 launching, and I've got my office set up at home with, three PCs all networked together. My wife and my kid and I are going to we're going to devour the retail final. We're waiting for it to be live.
Awesome.
We've all played a bit of it. You know, I've obviously played it. more hours than I can possibly articulate, but my wife and my son have been exposed to it very little, but they have been exposed to it. But we're, as a family, we're going to do it all together, and I can't wait, and we're going to have so much fun together. My son can't wait, my wife can't wait, and it's we're gonna get into that. And then, you know, I'm looking forward to the other blockbusters too. I like those, but I think, like,
well, Ni No Kuni is a good answer,
dude. That game is so magical to me. It's like, you know, and it's on some levels it's familiar enough. So, you know, it's there's some simplicity to it, but like the way they manage the overworld and just the art direction and the style, and I don't know all of what it's going to have in store for me. And I think there's some you know, wonder there as well that I'm looking forward to. So I hope it fulfills my dreams.
And the very last question I have for you, because we have gone an hour and 11 minutes. It's been an awesome, it's like,
you asked me a question.
It's like inside the actor's studio here.
You get
a
lot out of me.
In fact, I think this is the podcast this week. I don't even think I need to do any other part of a show. This
there
is gonna
we
be
go.
Great. So I've got to ask you, Randy, because you're the great guy to ask this question to. What's the one thing that the next-gen consoles need to do that would make you as a developer the happiest? Whether it's a service or a piece of technology.
Are we in dreamland? Or are we in...
About Dreamland, quick reality, because I know we got to move on to with you today.
It could be reality. I think the thing that would be the miracle that is totally possible, if these guys actually talked about it and realized why it would be a good thing, I would love to see Sony and Microsoft team up. I think that if Sony was responsible for the consumer electronics and Microsoft was responsible for the software, and those guys figured out how to ally together to have a PlayStation Xbox
X-Station,
and that there's some way to deal with, you know, certification and to deal with licensing and all that, so that those guys are both happy. Imagine if the combined resources, power, capability,
development studios,
just the combined result of those two working together would take the industry to a whole new level. Like, there's not a single person on the planet every single person on the planet that's ever thought about entertainment of any form would have to get that.
Yes.
They would have to. You just can't live and not need that. You'd have to have that. And it would be a multiplier. It wouldn't just be the sum of what they're both doing. It would be a multiplier. It would transform everything. And, oh my God, that'd be incredible. We would reach everyone. What an amazing world that could be in. And what's preventing that, of course, is a combination of pride and some combination of competition, the nature of their businesses. It's just the conversations are difficult to have candidly because they have to remain suspicious of one another. But if they could somehow, if someone high enough at both companies could somehow talk with one another candidly enough so they weren't actually imagined the possibility of an alliance there, and put what the big issues were on the table, so that, and found a way to work through those, so that, okay, if we work through these big issues, we'll trust that the organization can get through all the little details. Oh my God, that would be incredible.
And then how about a realistic thing? What's a realistic thing?
You don't think that's realistic? What's neat about that is it's not a technical problem. It's a human problem.
Right.
And which is totally solvable.
Those are worse than technical problems.
They are
in the business
ways.
World.
They are some ways, but it's solvable. It's solvable. I'm going to leave it at that.
Fair enough.
I can't top that.
You already know all the answers and you're under NDA, so we probably should leave it there. So Randy Pitchford, I want to thank you for, that was one of the best interviews for me that I've ever had. I hope everybody was entertained. An hour and 15 minutes. Yeah. Borderlands 2, of course, releases on September 18th. It is going to be huge. It's co-op. It's role-playing and shooting and every fun thing pretty much merged into one game.
We spent very little time talking about Borderlands, and I don't begrudge that. I really enjoyed your questions and I really enjoyed chatting with you. But I think if there's one thing that I could share with, you know, your listeners,
please do,
about it, if you're a gamer like us, there's never been anything we've ever done that we've put more personal passion and investment into. And I think as people play the game and see what we've done there, there's no question this is the best thing Gearbox has ever produced.
Well, and you said yourself, this game is for core gamers. It is not dumbed down for the mass market.
Not targeting them, but we have not encountered anyone who's given it a shot that's had a bad time.
Right. I'm sorry. I didn't mean it that way. Yeah, I just mean it is for you, listeners. It is for you.
If you're a gamer, you're who we're making the game for. So we're making it for us, and we're having a blast.
So September 18th is the big day. Pick up Borderlands 2. I guess if you pre-order at GameStop, you get the Slaughter Dome. Or creature slaughtered.
Yeah. And if you pre-order anywhere, you know, if you know you want the game already,
you probably already pre-ordered it.
If you haven't, you should, because we're giving away the first character DLC, which is the Mechromancer.
Yes.
And that's free if you pre-order it, if you're part of the Premier Club. I was really excited that our publishing partner stepped up to that, because that's going to be a $10 DLC for anyone that doesn't pre-order. And if you end up with the game and you play it, you're going to want. We're almost done with it, and it's that Necromancer's turned out so awesome. It's like I'm so in love with that character. So you just get it for free. If you already know you want the game, don't like, I just want as many people as possible to play our stuff. So I don't care that you're going to get it for free. I think that's awesome.
All right. And tune in to IGN at midnight on Friday, September 14th. That'll be Thursday night / Friday morning, 12:01 a.m. Pacific time for the first review of Borderlands 2. Randy Pitchford, thanks for coming out. Let's go do Up at Noon now.
Cool. All right. Thank you.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it, or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz. And how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.